if you can learn on the job, if you can learn from your mistakes, if you can grow in office, that's what we have to look for President Trump.
What lessons can the president learn from his predecessors in the White House? I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin and journalist David Von Draley talk about lessons learned from Presidents Lincoln, Roosevelt, Teddy, and Franklin, and others. It's the 11th annual Bennett Forum on the Presidency, sponsored by the Truman Library Institute in Independence, Missouri. This year's event featured Doris Kearns Goodwin, who has won 2 Pulitzer Prizes and numerous other awards for her best-selling books about Presidents Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson. Her book, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, was the basis for the 2012 Steven Spielberg film, Lincoln, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. David Von Draley is a noted journalist with The Washington Post, formerly with Time Magazine. He's also the author of several books, including Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln, and America's Most Perilous Year. He lives in Kansas City. More than 1,000 people attended this event, held at Unity Temple on the Plaza on November 4, 2017. Like many previous Bennett Forums, David Von Draley opened with a nod to President Harry Truman.
Harry Truman, who was one of the great autodidacts of American history, he had a high school education. He's probably our last president that we'll ever have who didn't go to college. But he was an enormous reader and said once that not all readers become leaders, but all leaders must be readers. He once prepared a recommended reading list for students in the summer that included, among a number of other works, Caesar's Commentaries, Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, the complete works of Burns and Byron, Creasy's masterpiece, The 15 Decisive Battles of the War from Marathon to Waterloo, the works of Shakespeare, especially Hamlet, Lear, Othello, and the sonnets. He acknowledged that you might not get through all of this in one summer, but that it would keep you out of mischief. But most of all, his most recommended work was Plutarch's Lives, of which he said, "Plutarch knew more about politics than all the other writers I've read put together.
Wow.
Now, he didn't have a chance to read the works of Doris Kearns Goodwin. But many of our presidents have been readers. Abraham Lincoln, according to his law partner, Billy Herndon, did not read widely, but read more deeply than anyone he had ever met. Shakespeare especially. Theodore Roosevelt was such a speed reader that he reportedly, and we can fact check this with the expert, read a book every morning before breakfast. He certainly read enough to have been able to write more than 30 of his own. Woodrow Wilson was, of course, a PhD historian, like our guest today. John F. Kennedy won a Pulitzer Prize for history, and so on. Many of our presidents have gone to school on the lives and experiences of leaders who went before them. Our current president is a man of many talents, but he is not a voracious student of history. He told my friend and colleague Mark Fisher in an interview last year that he has never read a biography of a president of the United States. I never have, he said. I'm always busy doing a lot. And now I'm more busy, I guess, than ever before. Tonight we have with us one of our greatest.
Every now and then it hits you.
One of our greatest living presidential biographers, both in the quality of the works and in the winsome quality of the writing. And She's the winner of virtually every prize given for this kind of work, the Pulitzer, the Lincoln Prize, the Charles Frankel Prize of the National Endowment of the Humanities, and so on. Her list of books, I won't read them all to you, but you know, of course, that she's written about Lincoln, about Theodore Roosevelt, about Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor, about John F. Kennedy and his family, and about Lyndon Johnson, and everyone that she's written is regarded as among the greatest works on those widely profiled presidencies. And so because the president hasn't been able to do this for himself, we're going to offer tonight her insights, the thoughts that emerge from her guys, as she likes to call them, for President Trump and his administration as they pursue the challenge of leading the United States in this tumultuous time. But before we get to that, I want to start with something maybe closer, even closer to your heart. Did you root for the Dodgers?
It was complicated because when the Dodgers left Brooklyn and went to Los Angeles, I just felt so abandoned. I mean, it changed my life, I thought. And we hated Walter O'Malley so much, the owner of the Dodgers, that we used to have this horrible saying in New York that what if you were in a room with Walter O'Malley and with Hitler and Stalin? And what if you had only two bullets? What would you do? And the terrible answer was that we would use both of them on Walter O'Malley. So there was a part of me that was thinking about the Dodgers and Sandy Koufax and Don Newcomb, and they threw out balls. And then there's another part of me that's such a sucker for the underdog who had the flood in Houston. And history showed that the Red Sox had won after the Marathon bombing, the Saints had won after Katrina. So I thought history was going to make Houston win because they were fighting for something even bigger than themselves, than their team, for their whole city that had undergone such adversity. So I would have been happy either way.
We got a great series out of it.
It was a great series. It doesn't give you solace when you lose, but when you, years later, get older, like the 75 World Series that the Red Sox lost to Cincinnati, considered one of the best World Series of all time, now I'm proud to have been part of that, even though we lost. But that takes getting older to know that.
Well, we know a little bit about that here in Kansas City. Now, shortly before his inauguration, President Trump was photographed at Trump Tower, and there in the background was a copy of Team of Rivals, perhaps the greatest one-volume book ever on the Lincoln presidency. If he had read that, in an alternative reality, if he had read that, what would be the key takeaways for him?
I think, you know, one of the most important things would be to go back to what you started off talking about, is that a person who's going to be a good leader has to understand human nature. And one of the things that Teddy Roosevelt said, our books are the greatest companions, and that there's no better way of knowing human nature than to read the great books of literature and history and drama. And for Abraham Lincoln, as you suggested, he taught himself how to read. You know, there were no books where he was. He only had 12 months of schooling, and yet he scoured the countryside for books and read everything he could lay his hands on. And so I think what Lincoln would tell Trump most importantly is that empathy, integrity, character, the very things that Harry Truman excelled in, are more important than anything else you've done. I think he could also tell him that all the leaders, he wouldn't know about the ones who came later, but he had gone through terrible adversity in his life, as had Teddy Roosevelt, who lost his wife and his mother on the same day in the same house, his wife dying of childbirth at 22, his mother at 49 of a sudden attack of typhoid fever, having come to take care of Alice, and FDR, of course, having his polio. They all got stronger because of adversity. And when Trump was running for office, he said, when he was asked about his temperament, he said, I have the best temperament of anybody who's ever run for president because I've always won. Completely wrong. It's when you get strong from having been through difficult times. I don't know how you can tell him such a thing like that, but I would give anything if my guys could come back and talk to him, because if he's not going to read books, then maybe if they appeared suddenly and they're in the room with him, you know, they're playing golf with him, then he can learn from them.
Well, and you had a role in doing that for our last president. You famously organized a number of luncheons for him to talk to presidential historians and further his education. If President Trump were to reach out to you, would you be willing to do that for him as well?
Of course. I mean, if you thought you can help the person who is now the president of the United States to learn from history, I mean, that's what President Obama wanted. We would come as our guys, not necessarily dressed up as Reagan or Jackson or Washington, but we would bring their insights to whatever problems he was having at that time. And it meant that he could learn from history. I mean, what does it mean to learn from history? It means you're learning from the people who lived before you, just like we learn from our parents and our grandparents. You learn from their struggles and triumphs. If you just think you're out there on an island alone and there's nothing anybody can tell you beforehand, I mean, they might have told him that the job was not going to be as easy as he thought. On the 100-day mark, I remember he said rather wistfully, you know, this is more complicated than I thought it was going to be. Healthcare is more difficult than I thought it was going to be. I had a really good life going. I liked what I was doing. I worked hard, but this is harder than I thought. Well, yes, this is what happens when we put somebody in office who's never had political experience, never had military experience, never even led. I mean, even if you get a businessman who's come into office with no political experience, they would have, if they had a big company, they would have had teams, they would have led, they would have had human nature. But his was a different experience. And I think we just were so tired of politicians that he seemed to come in from the outside, and the mood of the country fit a chord at that moment.
It seems to me that one of the reasons that he is president is that he mastered and was ahead of the curve in understanding the ability of a candidate and now a president to connect directly with voters, to create the impression that all the middlemen and intermediating institutions, the parties, the press, could be stripped away. And a lot of people thought they knew him from his reality TV show, felt that they had watched him lead and make decisions and fire people. And you have written well about a number of presidents who were ahead of the curve in mastering new modes of communication. And so this is not the first time that somebody's been...
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I think part of the question always about history is, does the man meet the moment or the moment meet the man? Which is it, the person or the times? And maybe somebody's suited for a time that they wouldn't be for another time in history. So when you think of it in the 19th century, when Lincoln is giving speeches, his capacity for writing is so valued because the speeches would be printed in full in the newspapers, then they'd be reprinted in pamphlets, and people would be reading them aloud in city homes and country farms. And then you get Teddy Roosevelt coming along at the turn of the 20th century, and he knows how to speak with this punchy language, speak softly and carry a big stick, and he's a cartoon figure at a time when the national newspapers are developing. And then FDR comes along at a time when his voice and his conversational style of speaking is perfect for that new age of radio. There's a wonderful story where he made people feel in those fireside chats that he was actually talking directly to you in your living room or kitchen. Saul Bellow said you could walk down the street on a hot Chicago night and you could look at everybody sitting in their living rooms and kitchens listening to the radio, and if you kept walking, you could hear what he was saying because you could just hear his voice as you went along. And a construction worker once was going home and his partner said, "Where are you going?" He said, "Well, my president, he's coming to speak to me in my living room tonight. I have to be there to greet him when he comes." And then, of course, Ronald Reagan and JFK were perfect for the world of television when there were three networks. So then Mr. Trump came along, and you're absolutely right. He just blasted through all the intermediaries, and with his capacity to tweet that new social media, that people felt he was talking directly to them. And of course, as we've learned, however, that is great during a campaign, but your words matter once you become a president. And he hasn't been willing to make that shift to understand. You know, Lincoln was great in extemporaneous talk. He could debate with anybody, but once he became president, he hardly ever spoke extemporaneously. Even when unions would win victories, they'd come to serenade him, and he would just say thank you to the soldiers, because he never wanted to speak without prepared understanding. So, I mean, when you ask what somebody from the past could instruct Trump, I think he would say to him, Lincoln had this wonderful means. He would talk about the tweets, because Lincoln, when he was angry with somebody, would write what he called a hot letter to the person, and all the anger would come out, and then he'd put the letter aside and hope he would cool down psychologically and never need to send it. The most famous case of that is after General Meade failed to follow up with General Lee's army after the victory at Gettysburg. Lincoln wrote him a long letter saying he was immeasurably distressed. He didn't do what he'd been asked to do. The war was going to go on month after month. But then he knew that it would paralyze the general in the field, so he put the letter aside, never sent it. It was never even seen until the 20th century when Lincoln's papers were opened, and underneath was the notation, never sent and never signed. So I think what he might advise Trump is have two different Twitter accounts. One is when you're happy and you just want to talk to people and you say, they're interested. I have to keep them interested like a circus. I have to keep them interested all the time. The other was when you're mad. It's just a hot Twitter account. It goes nowhere. And that would save him a lot of trouble and save us a lot of trouble as a country, because the language has so coarsened what a president talks about that it really is troubling, I think, for all of us.
It seems that I would agree that he doesn't hasn't appreciated Theodore Roosevelt called it the bully pulpit, that there, just by being in that job, your voice is amplified, you can speak more softly because your voice is going to carry. He's still sort of going at the volume of a real estate promoter in Manhattan.
It's really interesting. I hadn't thought about it until you just said that. I mean, Lyndon Johnson, when he was in the presidency, was so worried about appearing statesmanlike that he didn't use his ordinary voice, which may have been somewhat Trump-like, but it was so interesting that if we had known that person that we've heard on the tapes, he would have been a much more interesting figure to most people, those of us who knew him like that. But he always would stand behind a teleprompter, and they called the teleprompter Mother because he never wanted to be anywhere without it. So he had to travel places. There was one time when he was speaking somewhere, and he was speaking at a church, and the podium wasn't the same height as the normal podium that he had for the teleprompter. So he made them cut the pulpit down so it was the right height for him. But if you listen to him on the tapes, he had a fabulous, colorful way of speaking. And maybe it wouldn't have been fit, as you're saying, but we would have known him better. I mean, any of you have heard the tapes. They're coarse, but they're fabulous. He's brilliant. He's convincing people. He's persuading people. One of my favorite stories about the tapes has to do with, there was a guy named Don Kendall who was the head of CEO of Pepsi-Cola. And I met him years later after I'd worked for LBJ, and he said, now I know you knew LBJ when you were a young girl, but I have a story that you don't know. And he told me that when Nixon first became president, he asked Don Kendall to go to Johnson's ranch to talk about some complicated matter. And he said, I get to the ranch, Johnson's working on his memoirs, he can't remember what happened 20 years ago, 30 years ago, so he said, the only chapters that are any good at all, I had this taping system. He used to, whenever he had an important conversation, he'd turn the tape on, and he said, these chapters are coming out great. So you go back and tell your good friend Nixon as he starts his presidency, there's nothing more important than a taping system. And thereby, Lyndon Johnson contributes to the downfall of his good friend, Richard Nixon.
Oh, what a story. is this moment completely unprecedented? Have you, as you watch what we're going through, do you see historical parallels? Or no? I'll give you, the thing that I keep reminding myself is that if we had Nixon on my mind. If we had the opposite figure, Abraham Lincoln, at 9 months into his presidency, we wouldn't be building memorials and carving statues. I mean,
no, I think that's fair enough in the sense that you couldn't have known at that point if you were the outside looking in what Lincoln was capable of, but anyone who knew him well, even from Illinois, or from the state legislature, or from his runs against Stephen Douglas, they knew his qualities. They knew his character. They knew his empathy. They knew his depth. So I think that's a difference. I'm not sure you have a whole group of people now, but it's a fair comment. I mean, if you looked at JFK after the 100 days with the Bay of Pigs, disastrous experience. Right. The question is for both Mr. Trump, I think, and history, is JFK learned from that failure?
Right.
And he said, it's a hell of a way to learn things, but I learned. And then he changed his attitude toward military estimates. He changed the people that would give him advice on military issues. And he became a far better decision maker at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So the question is, yes, I think lots of presidents have come in early on, and it takes a while for them to get their feet. And Lincoln hadn't had that much national experience, just mm-hmm. the state legislature and one term in Congress. But if you can learn on the job, if you can learn from your mistakes, if you can grow in office, that's what we have to look for President Trump. But that means the ability to have self-reflection. It means the ability to have humility. I mean, the very qualities that Harry Truman excelled in, the ability to learn from mistakes, the ability to take responsibility for divisions, to shoulder blame, and the ability to be self-reflective. And as I say, humility is something that one of the funniest things Trump said, which I heard at one point, was, the reason I love Pope Francis so much is because he's very humble, just like me. But if he not coming in humble, not coming in self-reflective, and yet wants to do a good job, maybe one of the things we can hope is that he wants to be a great president, and unless he begins to learn and listen to people and grow in office, he's not going to be. And maybe he knows that at some level. So there's always solace. I mean, when you think about his history, ever seen anything like this? I mean, I think we've had worse times in history, which makes us feel better sometimes. I mean, I was telling a woman on the plane the other day, she said, has it ever been as polarized as this? And so I told her about the 1850s and when the South and the North were splitting apart, and there was a Southern congressman who had hit the Northern senator over the head with a cane, and the guy was out of office for two, and they had guns on the Congress floor. And she looked at me and she said, but that one didn't end up too well. It ended up in a civil war. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the interesting echo for this election is the turn of the 20th century. Because at the turn of the 20th century, you had the Industrial Revolution shaking up the economy just as globalization and technology have today. You had immigrants pouring in from abroad. You had all these new inventions, the telephone and the telegraph, that were changing the way of life. You had people in rural areas feeling cut off from the cities. There was a sense that life was moving too fast, and a lot of people then became willing to support populist candidates who mm-hmm. railed against the establishment and promised things they'll restore an earlier America somehow. So when you think about what's happened to a lot of the people who became Trump supporters, is they too felt maybe America was moving in a direction that was too fast for them, that the immigrants coming in from abroad were part of their problems, that these inventions are changing their way of life. And he offered a restoration of a somewhat simpler America. And so I think that's the echo from the past. And then the party structure would never have chosen a non-politician. When you had conventions that chose the candidates, of course, they're politicians choosing their fellow politicians. So somebody as an outsider who's never had political experience or military experience, they would never have gotten through a convention. But the conventions have been upended by primaries. And the question is now, are we going to be more and more susceptible to celebrities coming in from sports or Hollywood may have a little trouble these days now. But still, there was some function that parties used to perform, but our party structure is in trouble today too. So, but all these things are created by people. All the problems we have, they can be solved by people. We can do something about campaign financing, which is still, it's in my judgment, the poison in the system, which is why people don't want to go into politics. They have to just spend their time raising money. We can do something about gerrymandered districts. We can do something about responsibility for social media. FDR once said, men create problems, men can solve problems, but that's what we cannot lose in this country. Things are not out of our control. It may feel that way right now, But it isn't. And everything that's ever changed in the country has come from the bottom up, whether it's the anti-slavery movement or the women's movement, the environmental movement, the gay movement. All these movements then change the political structure, and we have to hope that the younger generation, that citizens will just recognize their responsibility now to not just look for some savior in Washington or some new person that's going to pop out of the Republican or Democratic Party, but start dealing with the state legislatures and the cities and the counties, because that's where it's going to have to come from.
Amen. I was going to save this for later, but you've just mentioned Hollywood and its current problems. So I wanted you to tell the story about, well, you were a professor, you were teaching at Harvard,
right,
in the history department, and you became a White House fellow, which is, for anyone who does not know, that's about as good as it gets. That's the cream of the crop. All the brightest 30-somethings in America. You were so courageous that you were going into the Johnson White House and decided to publish a paper critical of Johnson on your way in. I admire that. And you somehow didn't end up at the Bureau of Weights and Measures. But this started a relationship with President Johnson that brought you in contact with him. And he would not necessarily have passed muster in post-Harvey Weinstein America for some of his behavior. Did you ever have any experience in that way with President Johnson?
Well, let me go back a little bit to the story, which maybe some of you know. But what happened is I was a graduate teaching fellow at Harvard at the time, getting my PhD, was selected as a White House fellow. But I'd also been, like many young people, in the anti-Vietnam War movement. So a friend of mine and I had written an article against Lyndon Johnson, which we'd sent to the New Republic, but hadn't heard anything from them. I get the White House fellowship. We have a dance at the White House. I dance with John Johnson, not that peculiar. There's only three women out of the 16 White House fellows. But as he twirls me around the floor, he whispers, "I want you to be working directly for me in the White House." But then 2 days later, this article suddenly appeared in the New Republic, and the title was "How to Remove Lyndon Johnson from Power." So I was certain he would kick me out of the program. But instead, surprisingly, he said, "Oh, bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can." So I did end up eventually working for him in the White House and then accompanying him to his ranch to help him on his memoirs, the last years of his life. I'm not sure I ever fully understood why he wanted to spend so much time with me. I think it was because I was a good listener, and he told great stories. I loved listening to his stories. But what I later discovered was that half of them weren't true, but they were great. But the Harvey Weinstein incident, or the connection to it, is that so everything was going fine. I knew he had a womanizing reputation, so I was constantly talking to him about steady boyfriends, even when I had no boyfriends at all. Everything was perfect until one day he said he wanted to discuss our relationship. I was talking to one of you here tonight who remembered me telling the story, and he said, he took me to the lake, conveniently called Lake Lyndon Johnson. There was wine and cheese and a red check tablecloth. I was terrified. And then he said, "Doris, more than any other woman I have ever known," and my heart sank. And then he said, "You remind me of my mother." Now, I've never figured out if he really thought that. I mean, he thought she was an intellectual who had been squashed in her life and she could have written great books, or whether it was the most ridiculous come on line you'd ever imagine.
Oh, my goodness. You mentioned humility, and this is a question that I've wrestled with a lot in looking at successful presidents. I'm struck that the ability to learn, you know, in that incredible spotlight and to shoulder blame and to take criticism, to have the thick skin, all these qualities that successful presidents seem to need, to me, requires a really deep, genuine self-confidence.
Absolutely.
That is, and so when we talk about presidential humility, it's something different from an aw shucks, or it's so much confidence that they're willing and able to admit that they're not always the smartest person in the room, that they do have things to learn, and that that doesn't diminish them. I remember the story of someone saying to John Hay, Lincoln's secretary, after Lincoln had died, well, President Lincoln was such a modest man. And Hay said, no, that's absolutely wrong. You don't become great if you're modest. He was the least modest man that I ever met. And he gave it as an example that Nicolay and he would come into the office in the morning furious at the latest editorial and reading it and the criticism. And halfway through, Lincoln would sort of wave them away and say, I know more about it than they do. Just don't even bother reading that stuff. And that, in the time that I've spent, not much, but in the company of our current president, is kind of flipped around, that is not necessarily a genuine, deep-rooted self-confidence, and that instead there's a sort of need to be praised, celebrated. He needs to surround himself with his magazine covers and so on.
I mean, it's a very interesting point you're making, because I think you're right. Our definition of what humility is seems like humble, and that's not really what it means. In fact, Lincoln had a huge self-confidence, as you were saying, which I think came from early on somehow. He knew he was the smartest person even in his little environment. He knew he could read, he could think. He saw himself in the state legislature getting bigger each time, and he trusted himself. And so did Teddy Roosevelt, so did Franklin Roosevelt. What Franklin Roosevelt would say about humility is just that he had come from such a privileged background that when he got the polio, it connected him to other people to whom fate had also dealt an unkind hand. And that he said one time, if you've spent 2 years just trying to wiggle your big toe, because he had to go through so much to begin to just build his upper body so that even though he would never learn to walk on his own power again, he would have the strength to get himself in and out of a wheelchair. That taught him a different kind of, it's not a humbleness, it's teaching him that there are things in life that are really difficult and you're gonna have to have a hard time facing them, but you're gonna do it. And that's the kind of humility that somehow it's based on that deeper self-confidence that you're gonna get through this really difficult thing. And the worry I think about President Trump is the self-confidence that seems like it's on the surface. I'm not sure how deep within him it is. A self-confident person wouldn't worry about whether more people came to his inaugural than went to Obama's inaugural. You'd just be happy to think, I'm president of the United States. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it stuns me when I think about, this has nothing to do with anything except that you brought Harvey Weinstein in. I brought him in. when Clinton couldn't discipline himself and had his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, isn't it an adventure enough to be president of the United States? You need to have this extra adventure in your life. It sometimes just stuns me that people don't realize this is the most extraordinary job in the world. And if you do it right, it's a great job. I mean, FDR, somebody said to him once, how can you possibly get through the days when you have to make such difficult decisions and want to be president? He said, why wouldn't you want to be president? It's the greatest job in the world. And when you think about, I mean, this is something else about self-confidence that's important that I think Harry Truman had in spades. You're going to be making decisions, and those decisions are going to be difficult. And what Harry Truman had, Lyndon Johnson once said, he so was envious of Harry Truman's ability to make a decision and then not regret it afterwards, because he was constantly up every night worrying about whether the decision he made about Vietnam that day was right. He couldn't sleep. And he said, and Harry Truman was able to make that huge decision about dropping the atomic bomb with the right decision that he made. And he knew that he had only a certain amount of information at that time. You can't know what you knew 20 years later, but he accepted that. That's a deep confidence in oneself. And it's interesting, FDR said the same thing. He said, I know people who walk the carpets at night wondering whether they've made the right decision. As long as I know that they brought me the best information and all that I could know at the time, it was the best decision, I go right over and go to sleep. And that's that kind of decisiveness that I think we're surprisingly missing in President Trump. Despite the bravado, he keeps going back and forth on what decisions he's making. There is no sense of making a decision and sticking with it and not regretting it. It's just not even there. So it's that kind of leadership that we need to be looking for. And, you know, there was before Tim Russert died, the two of us were talking about the fact of how journalists cover elections. And he was so interested in saying that what journalists should really be doing is looking at the candidate who've all been somewhere before. They don't come out of nowhere. And of course, there are great magazine articles written about whatever they did before as senator or congressman or governor or mayor. But we should be talking about what kind of leadership traits did they show wherever they were. Did they build a team? Were they able to acknowledge errors? Did they shoulder blame? Did they have confidence? You know, were they able to bring other people around them who could criticize them? All of these things were known already. Nobody's going to change fundamentally when they get in there. They may grow or diminish when they get in. A challenge can either allow you to, they always say that a crisis creates a great president, and there's something to that because you can mobilize the country in a time of crisis, and there's a big historic challenge that you're facing. But you can also fail greatly at a time of great crisis. And if we only talked about our candidates that way, instead of who zings who in a campaign debate or who raises the most money, we're not taking seriously, especially now that it's our responsibility, the primaries, of who it is we're selecting. And we've got to figure this out better.
The point that you're making clear for me is that failure, difficulty, wrong decisions, all those sorts of things that we often punish in our politicians on the way up, those are the things that are actually making these great leaders. I think I hear you. FDR was on the national radar. He'd been nominated for vice president already before he had polio. He would have been a different president if he had never gotten sick.
Without a question. I mean, Eleanor said, you know, that he emerged from that polio just completely warm-hearted. There had been a kind of an arrogance about him before. I mean, he was such a handsome young man, privileged background, loved so much by his parents. And he had a kind of charm to him, but he could be kind of tough on people that didn't agree with him. And then what happened, it wasn't just the polio, but when he created Warm Springs, the rehabilitation center that he created from the bottom up, and he brought polio victims there, and he taught them how to get joy in life again despite their polio, and he felt great. It was that feeling, if what you need in a politician is when they feel a great sense of fulfillment about having done something that makes other people feel good. He called himself Old Doc Roosevelt, and in the pools, he would have games with them. They would learn to have fun again. They had dances in their wheelchair. They had picnics. He said they have to have joy in life again, and he was so proud that they wrote letters saying he'd changed their lives because he had made them feel they could be full human beings again despite their disability, and that changed him, I think, so that when he got into politics, really into the presidency and the governorship, he knew that feeling. I mean, I think once a politician feels that, then they're going for something larger. They're going for purpose, not just power. When LBJ got the Civil Rights Bill passed in 64, it was an extraordinary feeling to know that he'd done something by desegregating the South that would be remembered forever. And then he went for voting rights in 65. They told him, you can't possibly do this now because the country has to absorb the first one. But he knew that voting rights was essential. But that's because that fulfillment had come. And that's what you need to look for in a politician. Are they in it just for their own sense of power? Or do they want to use power for a purpose? Somebody said to LBJ right after JFK died, he made a decision at a joint session of Congress 4 days after JFK's death to say that civil rights, which the bill that JFK had introduced and was going nowhere in the Congress, was his first priority. They say, if you do that, you're going to destroy your presidency. You can't do that. It'll never work. It'll fail. Your presidency will fail, and there's an election 10 months later. And he said, well, what the hell is the presidency for? And that's it. So that's what we have to look for in people who go in public life. And that's where that adversity matters, I think. If you've been through something, you want to make your life meaningful. And you know that you've been through struggles. Other people are struggling in the country, and you want to help them somehow.
If you're just joining us, it's the annual Bennett Forum on the Presidency with presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Doris Kearns Goodwin and noted journalist David Von Drehle of The Washington Post. This event was held November 4th, 2017, and sponsored by the Truman Library Institute in Independence, Missouri. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio.
One of the things that feels very new about our time is the ability of people to kind of self-select their news sources, to cluster in groups around various identities. They might be right, they might be left, they might be crocheters who never look at any news sites but spend a lot of time.
They may be happier crochet than us.
I think they are. It has hit me that maybe this is a little bit like the period that Lincoln governed in, when anybody with enough money to buy a printing press could go into the news business, and there were thousands of little newspapers, and some were, and the consumers of news had to read differently than we came to read when we were coming up, because there was just three TV networks and a handful of papers. Do you have any thoughts about how, you know, what the job of news consumers is today compared to?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting point, because in the 19th century, if you were a Republican or a Whig or a Democrat, you would subscribe to your party's newspaper. And that's where you got your news from. That's before you have national newspapers with writing objective news. So you're just reading what, but you know you're just reading the Republican newspaper or the Democratic newspaper. So for example, during the debates between Stephen Douglas and Lincoln, if you were reading the Republican newspaper, you would hear that Lincoln was so incredible in the debate that he was carried off on the arms of his followers in triumph. If you read the same account of that same debate in the Democratic newspaper, it would say he was so terrible that he fell on the floor and they had to carry him out because he couldn't even walk. So fake news was going on back then. But you're right. People at least were aware of the echo that they were watching. And I suppose they're aware now if they're watching Fox or MSNBC. But what's at issue now, which is scary, are even fundamental facts are being qualified. And all presidents have had anger with the press, but the best presidents have gotten along with the press. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt had an extraordinary relationship with the press. He would have a barber's hour every midday when he'd be shaved by a straight-edge shaver, and he's sitting in the barber's chair, and the press are all around him, and he's moving all around the chair. And they said no barber had to be incredibly skilled. And then there was a journalist who did Mr. Dooley, those great columns, who had written a review of Teddy's Spanish-American memoir, and he said that Teddy so made himself the center of attention of every single battle of every part of the war that he should have called the book Alone in Cuba. And so what does Teddy do? Instead of getting mad, he writes him a letter and he says, I regret to tell you that my wife and my intimate friends are delighted with your review of my book. I've always wanted to meet you, so the next time you're in Washington, come and meet me. And the journalist was chary of meeting him because he was afraid he'd fall under his charm. They did meet. He continued to criticize him. Teddy would criticize him. And that was the relationship he had with the press. FDR had two press conferences a week. Imagine that. He would get ready for the morning paper, the afternoon paper. They had certain rules. It was easier without television because they could have off-the-record conversations. But he, in preparing for the press, he was preparing himself, and their questions helped him to know what was in the country at large. He would tease them about their hangovers. There was one time when one of them had missed the train, he wrote the column for him. I mean, but you know, but you can't have a war against the press. You can't say that the press people are evil people. They're not human beings. I mean, what we're accepting as normal language today is really scary, I think. You know, we just take it as yet another thing.
Does it bother you when presidents go on vacation or take a weekend off or play golf, or is that wasting their time?
Not at all. I mean, here's a question where I think there are legitimate criticisms of President Trump, but if he finds relaxation and replenishment by playing golf or going to Mar-a-Lago, there's many other things to criticize him for. All of my guys found the need to think and relax a central leadership trait. Lincoln actually went to the theater 100 times during the Civil War. He said when the lights came down and a Shakespeare play came on for a few precious hours, he could imagine that he was back in Prince Hal's time and the War of the Roses and not watching the war. And his greatest form of relaxation, of course, was his storytelling ability and his gift for humor. So that he had learned to tell stories when he was on the circuit in Illinois, when they'd travel from one county courthouse to the other. And he would entertain people when they stayed at the taverns at night for hours with his back against a fire telling stories. Some of them had morals like Aesop fables, but others were just simply hilarious. My favorite story that he always told, I was able to have Daniel Day-Lewis tell in even better fashion in the movie Lincoln when we were working on it. It had to do with the Revolutionary War hero Ethan Allen, who went to England after the war, and they decided, it was at a dinner party, to embarrass him by putting a huge picture of General George Washington in the only outhouse where he'd have to encounter it sooner or later. And they figured he'd be very upset about the indignity of George Washington in the outhouse, so he comes out of the outhouse not upset at all. And so they said, well, didn't you see George Washington there? Oh, yes, he said, I think it was the perfectly appropriate place for him. What do you mean, they said? Well, he said, there's nothing to make an Englishman faster than the sight of General George Washington. And Lincoln had hundreds of these stories. So you can imagine, if you are in the middle of a tough cabinet meeting, you're going to have to relax for a few minutes. I've told Colbert and Stewart that if Lincoln were alive today, he could match them one-on-one. So that's how he relaxed. Teddy Roosevelt relaxed by having physical exercise for 2 hours every day. He would either have a boxing match, a wrestling match, play a raucous game of tennis, or his favorite relaxation was to take a hike in the wooded cliffs of Rock Creek Park. And he would drag visitors and friends along with a rule that you had to move point to point. If you came to an obstacle, you couldn't go around it. So you come to a rock, you have to climb it, you go to a precipice, you have to go down. People are hating these walks with the president. But meanwhile, the French ambassador told the best story. So he comes, and he's got his silk hat on and his silk vest, and they're going to walk in the Champs-Élysées, and he finds himself in the woods chasing after Roosevelt. They finally come to a stream, and he thinks, thank God, it's over. And he said, judge of my horror, he wrote, when I saw the president unbutton his clothes and say, this is an obstacle, the stream, we have to go through it, so we might not as well get our clothes wet. So I, for the honor of France, took off my clothes. However, I left on my lavender kid gloves. It would be most embarrassing if we should meet ladies on the other side without my gloves. I love this guy. So anyway, the last relaxation is the best in a way. Franklin Roosevelt during World War II had a cocktail hour every night during the war. And the rule was you couldn't talk about the war. You could talk about movies, gossip, books you'd read, as long as you didn't mention the war. And after a while, this cocktail party mattered so much to him, he wanted the people who would be going to the cocktail party to live in the White House to be ready for the cocktail hour. So the White House became the most exclusive residential hotel you could possibly imagine. His foreign policy advisor, Harry Hopkins, came for dinner one night, slept over, never left until the war came to an end. His secretary, Missy LeHand, lived with the family. Princess Martha, in exile from Norway during the war, lived with the family on the weekends. Lorena Hickok, a journalist who had a relationship of nice emotional friendship with Eleanor, lived in a bedroom next to her. And Winston Churchill came and spent weeks at a time in a room diagonally across from Roosevelt's. So this is the second floor of the White House. There's only like 6-bedroom suites up there. And so I kept imagining these fabulous people in their bathrobes at night having these great conversations and wishing that when I'd been up there with LBJ when I was 24, I thought of asking, where did Churchill sleep? Where was Eleanor? Where was Franklin? But I wasn't thinking in those terms then. So I mentioned this in Washington on a radio program, the Diane Rehm Show, and it happened that Hillary Clinton then in the White House was listening. So she promptly called me up at the radio station, invited me to sleep overnight in the White House. She said we could then wander the corridor together and figure out where everyone had slept 50 years earlier. So 2 weeks later, she invited my husband and me to a state dinner, after which, between midnight and 2, the president, Hillary, and my husband and I went through every room up there with my map in hand and figured out, yes, Chelsea Clinton is sleeping where Harry Hopkins was, the Clintons are sleeping where FDR was, and we were in Winston Churchill's bedroom, which meant there was no way I could sleep. I was certain he was sitting in the corner drinking his brandy and smoking a cigar. In fact, that scene, that bedroom is the scene of another Naked Man story. So what happened is Churchill comes there right after Pearl Harbor, and he and Roosevelt are set to sign a document that put the Associated Nations against the Axis powers. But no one really liked the word Associated Nations. So early that morning, Roosevelt awakened with a whole new idea of calling them the United Nations against the Axis powers. He was so excited, he has wheeled into Churchill's bedroom, our same bedroom, to tell him the news. But it so happened Churchill was just coming out of the tub and had nothing on. So Roosevelt said, "I'm so sorry, I'll come back." Churchill, incredibly, in a very formal voice, with nothing on still, says, "Oh no, please stay. The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President." That's great. So anyway, the next morning, I couldn't wait to go in the bathtub, and then I truly felt I was in the presence of the greatness of the man. But there's another time when FDR goes on a fishing trip for 10 days, and it's 1940, the bombing of Britain is taking place, and they don't know how we can help Britain because of neutrality acts, and we can't sell things, and it's all a mess. He comes up with the whole Lend-Lease idea by being out of Washington, out of the bureaucratic muddle, in his whole head, and it becomes one of the most important parts of the war. So I think if they can relax, replenish their energy, find time to think, it's harder today than ever before in our 24/7 war world to think. And so if he finds relaxation, let him go, and let them go on vacations. It's a hard enough job as it is.
That was the greatest answer I've ever heard. To any question ever. You mentioned Secretary Clinton. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the First Lady and how that's changed, how important that is? Our current First Lady is keeping a lower profile than some of her predecessors.
Yeah, it seems like when you make a big change forward in a First Lady's role, that it will then create a requirement for the next First Ladies. But I think that it shouldn't do that. I think each First Lady should find her own place. If somebody has a child, they didn't choose to become First Lady in a way. They married somebody who did. I mean, when Eleanor Roosevelt really did change the whole ceremonial role of the First Lady, when she came in, first Lady to speak at a national convention, the first to testify before Congress, to have weekly press conferences. Indeed, at her weekly press conferences, she made a rule that only female journalists could cover her press conference. So all over the country, stuffy publishers had to hire their first female reporters. In fact, it's great. An entire generation of female journalists got their start simply because of Eleanor's press conferences. She sent so many memos to General Marshall during World War II about discrimination in the armed forces that he had to assign a separate general whose only task was to deal with Eleanor Roosevelt. But my favorite thing about Eleanor is that she was fighting from the beginning about women to go to work in the factories and the shipyards. And in the early days, the factory owners decided, we just can't have a social revolution in the middle of the war. The women will never learn how to operate these complicated machines. They'll distract the men on the assembly lines. Productivity will go down. So, however, by 1942, they needed to open their doors to women. Rosie the Riveters came in. And by 1943, women occupied 60% of the workforce in the shipyards and the airplane factories. Wow. And productivity went up rather than down. So it's even better. So these same old factory owners decided we better do a study and figure out how had these women learned to operate these complex machines so well and so quickly. I love the answer that came back on one of the study forms. They said it was very simple. When a woman, unlike a man, was asked to operate a new piece of machinery, she would ask directions. Any of us who ever used to travel with you guys in the days before GPS, never opening the window.
I love that. Let's go back to our shared interest in Lincoln. That husband-wife relationship is one of the most intriguing, mysterious. What do you think their relationship was, Abe and Mary?
It's very sad because, in a way, we judge the Mary-Abe relationship from what we know happened later, you know, that she lost her child in the middle of the Civil War, that she became depressed, that she had real troubles with stability, and later was put into a home by her son, thinking that she wasn't sane. But if you go back, and you and I were talking about this beforehand, the only way you can write history is to write it every step along the way, not what you know later. And I think when he first met her, I can see why he was attracted to her. I mean, she had a lot of education. She loved poetry. She loved drama. Her father was a political figure in Kentucky who knew Henry Clay personally, and Mary had known him as a little girl, and Henry Clay was his idol. She loved politics, which was unusual for a woman at that time. When he first met her, she was at her sister's house. Her sister's husband was the governor of Illinois at the time, and she was surrounded by a bunch of beaux, and he went up to her and he said, "Mary, I want to dance with you in the very worst way." And then she said, "Well, he certainly did once we danced." So I think there was, I understand why he fell for her, and I think, unfortunately, she had perhaps manic depression. And when they were young, though, however, she supported his runs for office. She supported, she believed in him when he lost. She believed he could be president someday. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, she had to bring up the kids. She had had slaves when she was younger, so she was thrown into a much more difficult lifestyle when they were young. And then what happens, she gets into the presidency, and she's looked down upon by the South because she has married this guy, Abe Lincoln, but then the North wonders about her because she's got brothers who are in the Confederate Army. The Easterners look down on her because she's a Westerner. And she tried to raise her stature by renovating the White House, something that Jackie Kennedy would get kudos for later. But at the time when they needed money for blankets for soldiers, she was overspending the appropriations. She did have a shopping problem. She one time bought 500 pairs of gloves, you know, right, which is part of that, perhaps that mania. Right. And then when their child died, little Willie, who was the little Lincoln, he loved poetry at age 10. He wrote, he kept records of all the battles, and he died from, I guess, cholera or typhoid fever. I can't remember which right typhoid. Now. Was typhoid, right? Mm. Oh, it's your year. It's your 1862, which is one of the reasons why the book he wrote about 1862, I so agree, it's the central year in the Lincoln presidency. So Rise to Greatness, if you've not read it, it's a great book. I had had it the whole time, and then when I knew I was coming, there it was in my bookcase, so I've had such fun in the last few days reading it. Anyway, this kid dies in February of 62. And he has a younger brother who's 3 years younger. And Mary can't even bear seeing the younger brother, Tad, reminding her of Willie. And so she sort of absents herself from motherhood, and Lincoln has to help bring that little kid up. And eventually she begins to recover a little bit when she goes to hospitals and she deals with wounded people, and she's pretty good with that. And the saddest thing is, on the last day of his life, they take a carriage ride together. And by then they knew the war was won. And Lincoln said to her, "You know, we've just got to try and be happier. We've been so sad now. Willie's gone, but we're going to be able to go traveling after this is over." And they both talked about where they wanted to go. And interestingly, I meant to tell you this, you two, Mike and Kim, what Lincoln said was, "I want to go to the Holy Land," and he wanted to go to California, and she, you know, she had Europe in her mind. And anyway, obviously, that was the night that he was killed, and then she sees her husband killed beside her, then her youngest son, Tad, dies later, and little wonder that she's just left with the older son, Robert, with whom she wasn't getting along at that point, and she did cycle downward. But I think Sally Field did a really good job in the movie of capturing her feistiness as well as her difficulty as a first lady and as a wife.
You've been listening to the 11th Annual Bennett Forum on the Presidency with presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Doris Kearns Goodwin. Goodwin has won 2 Pulitzer Prizes and numerous other awards for her best-selling books about Presidents Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson. Her book, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, was the basis for the 2012 Steven Spielberg film, Lincoln, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. David Von Drehle is a noted journalist with The Washington Post, formerly with Time Magazine. He's also the author of several books, including Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. He lives in Kansas City. The Bennett Forum on the Presidency was held November 4th, 2017, and sponsored by the Truman Library Institute in Independence, Missouri. You can hear previous Bennett Forums on the Presidency archived at our website, kansaspublicradio.org. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.